Honduras is on the brink of change, writes Suyapa Portillo Vieda in the journal Counterpunch. One reason for her optimism is that in the presidential election scheduled for next month, one of the leading candidates is a woman, Xiomara Castro de Zelaya, who represents the New Libre Party. Although the country has been dominated by the same two parties for the last 100 years, and though the human rights situation has deteriorated badly since the 2009 coup, which ousted President Manuel Zelaya, Ms. Portillo believes that Xiomara and her party have a chance to take the country in a new direction. Suyapa Portillo Vieira is professor of history in the Chicana Latino Transnational Studies Field Group at Pitzer College. As part of her community work, Portillo Vieira documents violence against the human rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transvestite, and intersex people in Honduras. Since the coup in Honduras in 2009, she has served as country expert in the media and for immigration asylum cases. Suyapa Portillo Vieira, thanks for joining us on Women's Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a bit about the history of your country, Honduras. I think most of our listeners are probably more familiar with what happened in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua during the 20th century. But tell us a little bit about what that period was like in Honduras.
Well, the 1980s were also a difficult period in Honduras. From 1962 to 1979, there was a military dictatorship. So the last president to be ousted was Ramón Villeda Morales. And since then, military juntas, you know, several of them took over up until the late 1970s. But it was believed that in the 1970s that it was important to have elections. And I think there was a very large movement with a president named Modesto Rodas Alvarado in the 70s, who mysteriously was either died or was killed. We're not sure. And so Suazo Córdoba rose to be his replacement and took office in 1980. We thought it was going to be a liberal party government that was going to be progressive. Everybody flocked to the capital to witness this transition of government. I mean, most of my mother's life, entire adult life, was lived during the military dictatorship and military presence and police checkpoints. And, you know, even as a child, I remember going from, you know, my birth area of Copan to the city, San Pedro Sula, and having to be pulled out of the bus. The bus had to be inspected. They checked our papers. I mean, this is common, right? A two-hour trip took, you know, 3 to 4 hours. So 1980 comes around, and everybody's really depositing a lot of faith into this new president, but it turns out he was just another puppet for the United States. I mean, really, that's when the most atrocities were committed against student movement activists, and labor leaders were persecuted. People had to be exiled. So this history of Honduras is not known, because when you study the history of what this Suazo Córdoba did, was act as an, you know, pretty much lend the country to the United States Embassy and to the U.S. Armed Forces so that they can train Contras, for instance, that were going to fight Nicaragua and to fight El Salvador and revolutionary armies. You know, and as I teach classes, I always remind students that there's always bad governments that people really thought were going to be good governments, right? For example, for us, thinking of here in the U.S., we really thought Obama was going to, you know, give us immigration reform, and he hasn't, right? He hasn't delivered for us. So that's what Suazo Córdoba did in the 80s. He participated with the U.S. in a terror campaign against revolutionary armies in Nicaragua, the FSLN and the FMLN in El Salvador. But also there was this internal campaign against activists that were supporting those efforts or trying to organize in Honduras efforts similar to those. You know, books like Prisión Verde, The Green Prison, written by Ramón Amaya Amador, you know, a historic book that documents the banana industry, were banned in the 1980s, right? So these are the things that most people don't know. People would traffic in books almost, right, to share this information among the organizing, when they were organizing banana workers, for instance, you know. So it was presented to the U.S. public as a democracy, but really it was filled with terror for activists and labor activists. You know, you see a lot of folks in the 1980s migrating alongside Salvadorans and Nicaraguans and Guatemalans, who are also fleeing a terrible condition in their countries. Honduras is critical to U.S. geopolitics in the region. Yet for Americans in everyday, you know, life and reporting, you don't hear anything about Honduras. And I think that's very strategic to serve the U.S. purposes.
So who was Manuel Zelaya? And how did he come to power? And then what happened that led to his being ousted in a coup in 2009?
Yeah, Honduras, one thing I forgot to mention is Honduras for the last 100 years have been, there are several parties that, you know, there's the Liberal Party, the Nationalist Party, and they go back to the late 1800s and the liberal period reform era, right, when the introduction of the banana industry. But over the years, you've had, you know, the Social Democrat Party. There's also the PNU, which is the environmentalist party. And there, lately in the 90s, there was the UD, which is the sort of the more progressive, you know, left of center, supposedly, party. But they never were able to amass the votes that these two parties, the Nationalist Party and the Liberal Party, have been able to dominate and control through these sort of promises that they make to small towns. And so Manuel Zelaya was part of the Liberal Party, and so was his father. And Manuel Zelaya, you know, he wasn't a special president when he first started. I mean, people remember him being sort of a hippie in college, but then, you know, kind of becoming part of the oligarchy as an older politician. But he comes into power by 2006. I was there to witness that. I was doing research for my current manuscript. And, you know, everybody was excited. You know, he was the better of several candidates. And you know, he was good looking. You know, he was sort of that charismatic figure that the party had lacked for a while, you know, but his first couple of years weren't particularly great. Towards the end of his term, he begins a relationship with Petrocaribe and the ALBA countries, the Bolivarian Project for the Americas. And really, it was sort of a trade agreement, kind of like the free trade agreement, but between southern countries. And he begins to learn about, you know, how, for example, Hugo Chavez had this radio show where he, you know, took calls from regular community members, or the importance to really check in with social movements, as you see happening in places like Brazil or Ecuador, right? People really wanting to check in about what the issues are. So he begins to do that. He begins to consult with social movements about different things. And all of a sudden you have these people in social movements going to the, you know, what would be the equivalent of the White House, right? La Casa Presidencial, to sort of discuss these issues. And he becomes, he's learning, right, from people, as he, you know, his counterparts have been doing. And I think this is really transformative for him. He begins to really engage, you know, the people. And one of the things that keeps coming up for many of the social movements is the fact that the Constitution is not useful, right? There's no protections, no Bill of Rights, if you will, right, for people, even though they're beautiful in the way that they look. They, for instance, one important thing is, you know, there's no way to recall a president or a government official who's doing a bad job. And let me tell you, many of these governors and countryside folks are placed in those positions by presidential power, right? So if your party wins, you get that job. You may not be equipped to be hold office. You know, people were stealing money. It's very corrupt. And so people were not able to remove those people from power. And the reason is because the Constitution was written in 1982, and it was put together through a constitutional assembly, similar to the one that Zelaya wanted to call together, right after the military rule of the 1970s. And in 1982, who was in power was Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was invested in Central America. So the Constitution really addresses the issues that the U.S. really wants to protect in Honduras, right? So it's an ironclad Cold War Constitution. It's not a people's constitution. He conceived of doing what they call the consulta popular, a popular consult, or a cuarta urna, a fourth ballot box, for June 29th, the special elections. It's kind of like seeking opinion from the people. And the question was, should we have a constitutional assembly so that we can change the constitution? So in every election, you have three ballot boxes, one to elect the president. And I'm really serious when I say they're boxes. This is not a technical, there's not going to be any chads here, right? We don't have that. The country does not have the capacity to actually mechanize this process, right? So it's a box that gets counted by real people, you know, ballots that get counted by real people. This is why observers are so important during these elections. There's one box for the president, one box to elect the governor, one box to elect the mayor of that particular area that you're in. And so the fourth ballot box would be that one that would ask, well, can, you know, is it possible to to have a constitutional assembly so that we can change the constitution. Immediately, I think right-wing forces as well as the U.S. were concerned, and they started to really campaign against it. And it was known 3 or 4 days before that he was going to be ousted, before June 28th, 2009, the day that that election was going to happen. It was sort of kind of announced. And I think President Manuel Zelaya didn't think that that would happen. I mean, it's, you know, 2009, it's not 1962 or 1936, you know, but it surely did happen. There's a great movie, if people want to check it out, called Quien Dijo Miedo. You can find it on YouTube for free. Who Spoke Fear or something like that. And, you know, they show up to his house, they wreck the doors, they capture him in his pajamas, they put him on a plane, very similar to how the 1962 coup happened with Ramon Villeda Morales, right? In his pajamas, he's flown to Costa Rica, you know, but before the plane stops to refuel at Palmerola, Soto Cano Air Base, which is run by the United States, and the country goes into a media blackout. So if you can imagine not having no television, your phones are mysteriously not working, radio as well, right? If you turn on the TV, you can only watch mass. And so people, of course, take to the streets. And since 1954, during the Great Banana Strike of 1954, where 25,000 workers go on strike in the entire country, strikes with them for a couple of days, this had not been seen in Honduras. All of a sudden, this movement has surpassed the 1950s movement, and people all of a sudden, you know, of all colors, shapes, sizes, gender, sexuality, the gender identities, you know, you have people from different parties also protesting this egregious act, because the president of the Congress at the time, also Liberal Party, Micheletti, who worked with Manuel Zelaya, was put there by Zelaya, gets up in front of Congress and says, I have a signed letter that says that the president resigns. And his signature was faked. And this is on Honduran national TV, but we, the diaspora, the Hondurans outside of Honduras, are watching CNN and all the other shows, you know, Univision and Telemundo report on Zelaya in Costa Rica saying I was kidnapped. So it's this, we can see it all here, but Hondurans can't see it all. So that morning, I get a phone call from a family member at 6 a.m. saying, you know, there's been a coup and nobody's reporting on it. And so then we proceed through cell phones and through sort of chat rooms to, you know, to communicate with people and let them know, no, this is what President Zelaya is saying on TV. And that media blackout lasted pretty much the entire year. The U.S. Embassy in Honduras, as well as the State Department, led at the time by Hillary Clinton, were in denial, saying this was not a coup d'etat, this was not a coup d'etat, when everybody in the world could see that this was a coup d'etat.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Professor Suyapa Portillo about the emergence of a women-led movement for social change in Honduras. And since the coup, things have gotten worse from a human rights perspective, as I understand. And I also have heard that women leaders have been particularly targeted by the government. Is that true?
Yeah. One thing that you see in Honduras, and it's interesting that you also see that in Egypt, is the leadership of women, not just leaders from the 1980s, but new leaderships emerge from the 90s on. Women like Berta Cáceres, who's currently being persecuted, you know, Miriam Miranda, the leader of the Afro-descendant group Ofrane, Berta Cáceres with Copin, which is an indigenous resistance group that has existed for a very long time. You also see leadership, you know, President Manuel Zelaya's wife, who was a wife when he was president, becomes this sort of very popular leader. She goes out to the streets and protests. She did not leave Honduras to go by his side. She stayed in the country, and she walked with the people, and, you know, she endured all of the things that the Honduran people endured. I mean, she went, she got gassed, she, you know, they got pushed out. And then when he enters, President Zelaya tried to re-enter a couple of times, once in July when the first murder occurred. A young boy, Isis Obed was killed by a sniper at the airport. And the media actually, this is just on a side note, the media tries to hide that they killed him. Well, we're watching it live, right, through Telesur, and the media tries to hide it on the newspapers by photoshopping the blood out. the next day, and so they were called by international press agencies, called out. Those newspapers have lost a lot of credibility nowadays because of that incident. So he tries to re-enter. He's not able to. He then tries again through other means. He was accompanied by members of the OAS, you know. But then eventually enters secretly through Nicaragua, I think, and ended up at the Brazilian embassy in Honduras and was held there captive. Many people from California went down there and we tried to visit him. So that's when his wife, Xiomara Zelaya, joined him. Xiomara Castro de Zelaya joined him in the embassy, but she never left Honduras. And I think that's really important to know about her. You know, so she emerged from being a housewife to being this popular leader. And she's pretty popular. Even people that won't say that they're going to vote for her publicly, you know, the polls show that she's pretty much, you know, at the very top of the list. Also, women in labor movements, like you have two really powerful heads of unions right now that are women. And also a really amazing, charismatic lesbian begin to really work together and formed a group called the Feminists in Resistance that put out this really important document at the time, was critical to looking at how this coup is affecting women. Women, when they were going out to protest, for instance, were beaten particularly bad, right? There's this misogyny that you would see from the police towards women's groups. And who was marching for women and children and older women, you know, youth, young women. And, you know, they were hit. Sometimes they were hit between their legs. So, you know, with the baton up towards their crotch area. So, you know, things that didn't happen to men. The men were beaten in a pretty standard way that you probably saw on TV. But the violence against women was sort of hidden, right? You didn't see that on TV. So it was really important for the Feminists in Resistance to document that. For there were four rapes that occurred after protests where women were pulled out by police and raped. One woman in one situation was raped. She was told to stay quiet. She went to the only progressive radio station in the North Coast to denounce this rape, and they came back to rape her. So she had to leave the country. You have also abuse against transgender women who were working in the streets. There was a state of siege imposed in the country right after. And so a lot of the trans women that worked the street really didn't know about it, right? And so some of them were shot. You know, they were violated and shot. And so there's been over 100 murders of LGBT people, with the majority of those being trans women. You know, we call it a human rights violation. You know, but if you look at sort of the standards set up by organizations that work with disappeared people or people that have been politically persecuted, rarely do they include hate crimes as part of their rubric for determining whether this was a political act against someone, right? And when they go out to protest, there was a case of a couple of gay men who were beaten up during protest. There's the case of a leader in Tegucigalpa, Donny Reyes, who was beaten, taken into police, raped, mutilated while the police had him. And then there's also the case of Walter Troches, who was killed in December of 2009. He was very actively marching and protesting the coup, and also had a relationship to Xiomara Castro de Zelaya. He was also killed in December 2009 while he was doing his work promoting safe sex in the streets. And then also Eric Avila Martinez was killed just last year. And he was very political. He was running for office, one of the first gay candidates to run for office, you know, once the party was created after 2011.
Can you actually back up a little and talk about how the Libre Party, the new party, was formed and who are the different forces that are part of it?
Okay. After June 28th, June 29th, everybody hits the streets to protest. And from June 29th, 2009 to, I would say, up until January of 2010, people protest every day, almost in every big city. In every big city, for sure, but almost in every town. And they at first are called La Resistencia, the resistance. But as time passes, they form a group called the National Resistance Run. And the beauty of this group was that it really encompassed all and brought together all the social movements, the indigenous and Afro-descendant groups, as well as the labor groups, the youth, and then these new formed parties that kind of spring up in little communities. You know, like you have the neighborhood of Barrio Kennedy, the Colonia Berlin, Libre Party. So all these little neighborhoods had their own committee in resistance. And that was the beauty of the National Resistance Front. When you get to a point where you had the grandmother, you know, from the neighborhood who lived the time of Caria Sandino, who lived the coup in Ramon Vieira Morales coup, who lived, you know, all the dictatorship, participating all of a sudden and sharing with younger people this history, right, of what happened and how, you know, what were some of the major movements, what were some of the egregious things that happened in history. And all of a sudden you begin to see young people that never voted, right, really, really unengaged young people coming to these meetings, you know, these meetings, and then making it to the national assemblies. So that was the beauty of the National Resistance Front, which I think, you know, how long were you able to, going to be able to sustain these protests? And I don't live in Honduras, so when I got to see them, they were pretty magnificent. And they were beautiful. You'd see everybody's participation, people from all walks of life, races, colors, you know, to see. It's pretty magnificent in a country as misogynist and machista as Honduras to see, you know, gay men and lesbians get up on that podium and talk about what their issues were. I mean, it's pretty magnificent and historic, I think. But how to sustain that? The 1980s options where groups armed themselves wasn't an option in Honduras, precisely because of all the deaths that happened in El Salvador and Nicaragua and in Guatemala, right? That's a heavy cost that people paid in those countries, and that was not an option, you know. So the idea was, you know, to organize a political party. And the political party idea, I'm not sure where it comes from, but it became viable towards, I would say, 2011, late 2010, early 2011, and the debate starts, you know. And so there's always a sector that didn't believe in forming a political party and remaining a social movement. But there was a strong enough sector that wanted to create a political party. So in June 2011, they hold a national convention of the National Resistance Front, and the party was created. But to appease everybody, they also did not get rid of the National Resistance Front. So the National Resistance Front exists as a social movement still, and the Libre Party is their proposal, if you will, for change. And in this process, more than four or five parties get created. So it could be people that split out from the bigger movement, like one of the candidates for a particular current is a gay reporter from a sports reporter. He's actually not very progressive, but he's kind of like an Arnold Schwarzenegger, if you will, right? So there's almost a party just for everybody. So now there's nine candidates that made it onto the ballot. There were many, many more proposals, but nine made it on. What that says is that the resistance, the National Resistance Front, effectively opened the door for all these other people to come through and be on the ballot, breaking down this bipartisanship that has existed, this sort of two-party rule.
In recent months, the government has taken some steps to crack down further on dissent. You know, do you think that that might escalate, and is there any chance that they would try to prevent the elections from going forward if it seems like Xiomara is going to be elected? Or do you think that they might try to stop people from voting or rig the vote in some way?
I am much more concerned about the U.S. Embassy role. You know, the U.S. embassies in Latin American countries have been notorious for their sort of counter activity towards, you know, elections, progressive elections. Although the ambassador has said that she would respect the outcome of the elections, I think that, you know, what we saw during the coup and their negation of the coup, and then getting WikiLeaks and reading how the U.S. Embassy was clearly aware of what was going on and was reporting to Washington exactly what was going on, but they chose to, almost like a PR campaign, they chose to not call it a coup. I can't imagine what they would come up with, but I'm sure that they are thinking very clearly about what's going on in Honduras. Again, this is a strategic place. I mean, you have China built in Nicaragua building a canal right next door. The current government of Porfirio Lobo Sosa, who was the president that was elected in 2010, it was elected right after, you know, the whole debacle with the coup. The only reason he was elected right after was because most of the resistance withheld their vote. So there was a 60% abstention during those elections. In some ways, the abstention allowed for his party and Pepe Longo to do whatever they wanted, right? So they have been selling off the country. They have been, they signed on a law called for the model cities, which is basically a gentrifying project. So that whole machine has created a set of laws. The one law that I think is pretty harmful is the creation of a national police, which was eradicated in the 80s. A national police that are military on the streets. So that happened in late August, early September. So now you see military men in every corner, highways, malls. I mean, with high-grade machine guns, you know. I foresee that's going to be a problem for the safety and the security of people. Instead of those people protecting borders, I think they're going to harass borders.
You mentioned Berta Cáceres, and a few weeks ago, October 10th to 12th, were declared International Days of Support for Berta Cáceres. Who is she, and why this special emphasis on her case?
So Berta Cáceres is perhaps one of the most brilliant leaders of the indigenous movement in Honduras. I really think the indigenous movement in Honduras had been silenced for many years, right, since colonization. I think after the 1997 in Mexico and the birth of the Zapatista movement really inspired a lot of indigenous folks to rise and organize and to really figure out what's going on in their communities. And you see the birth of COPIN, which is a Lenca organization in southern Honduras that works with people, you know, organizing people, but also building consciousness and also making sure that they have the resources that they need, you know, healthcare and, you know, jobs and, you know, access to land is very important, right? They see themselves being pushed out by these big landowners or these big companies. Berta Cáceres comes out of the 1990s movement, very bright. She's a feminist in resistance. You know, she's not afraid to talk about patriarchy. So she's a different kind of leader and really one of the leaders of the National Resistance Front with a huge base of indigenous people. One of the things that's happening with this current government, Pepe Lobo, is that they're really kind of selling off land, right, and bringing in investors for hydroelectric companies to build dams or for mining metals. And that's a very big movement. And so Berta Cáceres, her community was one of the communities affected by Sino Hidro, which is a Chinese development company that was coming in to build a dam in a place called the Aguasarca Dam as a project. And there was a company in Honduras called the Energéticos Desarrollos NESA, and together they were going to build this dam. But the people and Lenca activists basically protested this because they would be sort of kicked out. And the main way of protesting is to take over access roads. So these are sort of really rich territories, and there's often just one single lane road. The project that I'm talking about, the Aguasarca Dam project, had the protection of private security guards, which are becoming much more popular in Honduras, right? They're armed private security guards, but also the Honduran military. So the military and the private security forces have terrorized the activists. They have opened fire on a group of protesters. So all of this activity that people are doing is peaceful activity. They're not armed. The Honduran counterpart of this project, VESA, is accusing Berta of actually getting in the way. Right. What's really ironic about this is that's not their land. That is Lenca indigenous land. You have every right to protect your home. And so Dessa is accusing her and the organization of trespassing and causing havoc there, which is not true. They're the ones that are actually trespassing into indigenous land.
Suyapa Portillo Vieda is professor of history in the Chicana Latinos Transnational Studies Group at Pitzer College. Since the coup in Honduras in 2009, she has acted as a media expert on her native country. She also documents and advocates for the human rights of lesbian, gay, bi, and trans Hondurans. She joined me by Skype. In September, a judge issued an arrest warrant for Berta Cáceres. Amnesty International and School of the Americas Watch have called for the charges against Berta and her co-defendants to be dropped. Find out how you can help pressure for her release at our website, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. A delegation from the Bay Area will be joining others going to Honduras in November as election observers, and we will have them on when they return to talk about what they witnessed. This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM. I'm Kate Raphael, back in a minute.